some years they don't introduce. Would you like me to introduce you? Would you like me not to introduce you? Okay.
Good morning, good morning. I apologize about my voice. I've been battling a bit of a cold. But thank God for the microphone. Good morning, good morning. We are blessed as Jews living in a very, very inspiring generation. For thousands of years, we were disempowered. We were victims of history, scattered across the globe, unable to directly affect our national fate and our national destiny. And we've been chosen to be part of a generation that has witnessed the rebirth of our homeland, the resettlement of our people, and an opportunity to be authors of history rather than pawns of history. We recited Hallel yesterday, Hodu l'Hashem ki tov. But we're also blessed as human beings. Man is not a solitary creature. Man is social. Man is political. And he lives in clusters, in societies, in groups. Solitary man has no need for law or government. He lives alone. He lives a nomadic lifestyle, foraging for food, protecting his homestead. Social, political man requires government. An apparatus to govern, to uphold law, to protect the innocent against the abuse of the criminal and the strong. And for millennia, human beings, humanity, struggled to devise equitable systems of governance and just and fair political systems. And for thousands of years, humanity failed. Strong-armed despots, authoritarian rulers, seized power, claiming divine right to that authority, and employed that power to exploit, to persecute, and to abuse their subjects. And then finally, a few hundred years ago, man renaissanced. The age of reason, the age of science, encouraged man to rethink his world, to reimagine his identity, and to devise more egalitarian and moral forms of government, or governance and government. And the great age of democracy was launched. The muskets in the new colonies, the guillotines in Paris, each in their own way heralded a brave new era for humanity. An era of democracy, freedom, but not just democracy and freedom, but an era of human dignity, human dreams, human identity. And as human beings, we celebrate the opportunity to live in a democratic world. And as Jews, we doubly celebrate that opportunity. Because Jews were always disproportionately persecuted. And Jews were always discriminated, more so than their non-Jewish or Gentile peers. So we don't just celebrate democracy as Homo sapiens or human beings. We celebrate democracy as Jews. And we thank Hashem, we thank God for inspiring human beings with political instinct, with the ability to devise a form of government that reflects His divine morality, His dignity. We participate in democracy, we embrace democracy, and thank God over the last 150 years, in this country as well, Jews have been at the forefront of the democratic process. But there are dangers to democracy. I'm an American, so allow me to quote an American poet. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "Every reform is merely a mask, under the cover of which a more terrible reform advances, which dare not name itself or announce itself. Every revolution creates giddiness, euphoria, excitement, but it masks, it camouflages certain dangers to human experience, and in particular, dangers to religious identity. So as Jews who embrace democracy, who celebrate the ability of mankind to achieve finally just forms of democratic rule, what are the dangers? What are the challenges? How are we able to embrace this reform while still maintaining our core Jewish values in an unadulterated, non-contaminated fashion? So I want to discuss 6 challenges of democracy, assuming time allows. The core clash, of course, is the fundamental premise. Democracy celebrates and asserts human freedom. Man is born free. Freedom is the ultimate agenda. It is the end of man. And democracy marshals all of its forces, rallies to protect and to preserve those freedoms. Is this how we see ourselves? Is this our profile as religious Jews? We're defined as free people. This is the Sinai Indaba. I think it's the 7th. I attended the first Sinai Indaba, I think 7 years ago. We all attended the very first Sinai Indaba. It was in a desert. And I can assure you the catering wasn't as fancy. And God imposed a stony will upon humanity. And we embrace that will. And we live lives which are summoned and mandated, not free and aimless. Our sages had a very interesting way to phrase it. Source number 2. Did the handouts make their way out? Sheets never made it. Okay. Put the sheets on the side. Our sages said, Ein lecha ben chorin, ela mi she'osek batara. Who is a truly free man? A human being who embraces God's will. And it seems paradoxical, because on the surface, the embrace of God's will seems to limit us and to restrain us, to suffocate, to suppress. We know that God has empowered us so many traits, faculties, emotions, capabilities. But if they run amok and they're expressed in an unrestrained fashion, in an unbridled sense, well, modernity has showcased the horror of such unrestrained freedom. It's called addiction. It's called a human being who is slave to hormones, to urges, to needs, to dependencies, whose entire energy is sapped, whose entire schedule is compromised. I can't imagine a form of slavery more tyrannical than addiction. And that's the ugly side of unrestrained freedom. Torah, religion, is a code book. Every trait that God embedded within you has its moment, has to be expressed in the right way, from our ego to our pride, to our sexuality, to our ambition. But the Torah is a guidebook. How to express it? In what context? Because if expressed disproportionately or unregulated, it can devour, it can consume, it can trespass on others. And more so, more than just the notion of avoiding the tyranny of uncontrolled emotions, traits, and ambitions. We're all slaves to the basic reality of the human condition, our own mortality. All of our accomplishments, all of our structures, the palaces we build, will fade with the passing of time. Everything we accomplish in life is transient and ephemeral. though it seems to be stable and durable. But we stride two worlds. We soar beyond this planet. We fly beyond Daedalus and Icarus, because we're part of two worlds. And we defy immortality. We're mortality. Because through our activities and our deeds in this world, we achieve eternity. We liberate ourselves from the shackles of human mortality, which ground the human spirit and regulate human activity. So the first challenge is to remind ourselves that our terminus, our goal, is not to be free. At least freedom, as it's defined in unrestrained and unlimited behavior. It is, as Isaiah Berlin once wrote in a very famous essay, not freedom from, but freedom for. Not freedom from restriction, but freedom for accomplishment. Healthy, calibrated, disciplined lives. Lives of dignity, lives of nobility, lives of virtue, lives of value, lives of ideals, rather than lives of self-indulgence, self-centrist, or self-centric interest. And that's the first challenge of democracy. Not to buy into that illusory, confusing form of freedom which modernity poses. The second challenge is related to, of course, Passover. Democracy in the democratic era has also witnessed the dissolution of hierarchies. If every man stands equal before law, then any racial, social, ethnic hierarchy is immoral and is repressive. And we live in a meritocracy, a pluralistic society based on accomplishment and achievement, not based on race, not based on background. And as I mentioned before, this is all welcome. But the dissolution and disappearance of hierarchy in our world, a hierarchy-less world, has led to the destabilization of a hierarchy which stands at the core of Jewish tradition. And that's the family hierarchy. The family is the instrument for religious instruction and transmission. How do we hope to transmit our traditions? Texts, books, lectures, indabas, rabbis. God save us from the rabbis. The family, the hearth, the home. Religion is mimetic. You witness and you replicate. You live through common experiences, multi-generational experiences. Think of where you'll be 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks from this past Friday night, the Passover table, with your children, your grandchildren, your parents. Think of what Passover means beyond ideas and texts. It's sounds, smells, optics, visuals. It's powerful. And the family unit, and the role of family, is under siege. In a world which suggests that hierarchies of authority and moral authorities are no longer relevant. And that's the second challenge. Remember the night of Exodus, the Jews departed Egypt and they were asked to place blood on the doorposts. God needs blood as a signal to denote Jewish homes from Egyptian homes. God perceives all. Our sages tell us the blood on the door was not a blood to symbol a Jewish home for God to pass over that house. It was the blood of the first sacrifice. And every sacrifice, the paschal offering, requires some application of blood on an altar. But in Egypt, they had no altars. They had no shrines. The temple was yet to be constructed. So the Jewish home served as the first altar. The two doorposts and the top post were the site of a holy ritual which typically occurred surrounding the altar. But on this night, the Jewish home was an altar. And that's the second challenge of living through democracy. Maintaining at least the hierarchy of family. I have to say, having experienced the South African community multiple occasions, been invited to speak, the family structures are so solid and powerful. A sense of identity, not just towards individual self and arc, but towards family, community, and history. That's where tradition is conveyed. More powerfully than texts and theoretics or abstract ideas. And that's the second challenge of living through democracy. The third challenge, beyond avoiding this addiction to freedom, or the addiction which stems from freedom, and the dissolution of hierarchy in our world. Third issue is a bit more subtle. Democracy, the constitutions, declare the rights of man, life, liberty, equality, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And democracy's primary role is to preserve those rights. And we create intricate systems of law and justice to preserve human rights. But political concepts don't grow in a vacuum. They infiltrate our identity. They percolate our existence. We have become creatures of rights. We define ourselves by our rights. What are my rights? What are my civil rights? What are my individual rights? If they've been compromised, I'll sue or prosecute. That's our profile. That's our profile. We live for rights. That's why we're placed in this world. For rights. We're not creatures of rights. We're princes of duty. We are placed in this world with a mission, with responsibility, with obligation to represent God in this world. I'll speak about that in the second session at 1, and the challenges of living in Israel and representing his presence to improve this world. This world is transient. By the time we occupy it, we work tirelessly to improve it for those who follow in our wake, to improve the conditions for those who share this world with us, Jew and non-Jew. Very famous book, probably the first modern moral book. It's known as the Mesillas Yesharim. It was written by an Italian in the early 18th century, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. It has become enshrined as the classic moral book. He begins his book with a very, very powerful and compelling phrase, Ma Chovat Adam Ba'olam. What is your duty in this world? Why were you placed in this world? Why were you given the resources? What is God's plan? There's no free lunch. You're not here for indulgence today, Christian or Chinese food. Not here for self-interest. But we've become obsessed with our rights. And it begins to percolate. I live for rights. I live for mine. Perhaps the greatest satire upon the ridiculous nature of rights spiraled out of control. About 15 years ago in the United States, I'm embarrassed. A woman entered a McDonald's, ordered a coffee, and by accident the coffee spilled. She burned herself. She actually sued McDonald's for personal injury and infringements of her rights. And you know what? She won. $15 million. It's embarrassing. My rights. My needs. What do I have coming to me? Selfish. Egotistical. Rather than noble. Idealistic. I teach in a school of 500 boys. And when the boys depart
My school, after a year or two of studying, and sometimes 5 years, those that serve in the army, they ask me, Rabbi, how will I be successful in 20 years? If you meet me in 20 years, what will determine whether I've been a success? And I tell them it's a very simple question. I want to ask you one question. If you answer this question successfully, then in my perspective, you've been a success. What do you live for in your life beyond yourself? What ideal? Your family, your people, your state, your religion, your God. Be an idealist. Live for something beyond your own four corners, beyond your own self-interest. Choose whatever you want. But live a life of ideals and passion, and then a life of self-preservation. Of course our rights have to be protected. Without the protection of our rights, we can't dispense our duties. If man is constantly abused, man is constantly persecuted, and his spirit is crushed, his energies are depleted, and his duties remain unfulfilled. But rights are not an end to themselves. Rights are means, so we can fulfill our duties. And that's the third challenge of modern democracy. Number one, the sense of freedom as a terminus.
Number two, the dissolution of hierarchies. Number three, refashioning our imagination as creatures of rights rather than as creatures of duty. But then there's a fourth. It's subtle, but it's very corrosive. The notion that every person shares an equal vote leads to the notion that not only is every vote equal, but every moral opinion is equal. And if we're equal in the ballot box, then we must be equal in the moral conversation. Welcome to our world. It's called the world of moral relativism, where there's no absolute value, there's no black and white, there's no good and evil, there's no fixed north. Every perspective has to be understood. Every act has to be justified if seen from the perspective of the perpetrator. A suicide bomber, a homicidal murderer, to become a freedom fighter defending his national rights. A foul, vulgar racist who spews venomous insults to others is just defending his wounded national pride. Our moral compasses have been thrown into chaos. Because we live in a world of pluralism. Because we live in a world of multi perspectives. That has to change. The sense that in the moral world there's a clear compass. There are clear divisions between victims and aggressors. Between those who value life and those who attack it and assail it. The period of the judges. It's a very sad period. It was a 400-year period in which Jewish history took two steps forward and three steps back. Opportunities were betrayed, leading to God's punishment, penitence, forgiveness, reclamation of opportunity. And there's a verse in the book of Judges which describes the lack of federalization, the lack of monarchy. Ish kol ha'yashar be'inav yaseh. Everyone did as they chose. Self-mediation. Self-arbitration. Moral arrogation. Arrogating moral rights. Sometimes when I speak to my students and I ask them what will turn you successful one day, it's not just your idealism, but I'll say, who's your rabbi? Who's your moral authority? Which person do you consult when you face a moral crossroads? And listen carefully, not necessarily agree to every time. Because you have to maintain your own individuality and your own identity. But listen carefully and challenge your presumptions and seek high ground. And be happy and grateful to those who call you to higher ground rather than those who validate life in the valley. Challenge you to newfound opportunities by calling you to your behavior in a way that's respectful but earnest. Welcome to this world.
no absolute right or wrong.
The world of moral relativism shaped by the world of democracy. And then number five. Democracy has a partner. Democracy evolved in tandem with another very, very powerful movement. If man's political freedoms have to be unleashed, then so must his economic freedom.
And it's not incidental that democracy and capitalism emerge side by side. Free market economy, supply and demand. And of course, these two movements cross-pollinate. In some countries, democracy begins and democracy ultimately yields capitalism. In many instances, it's capitalism that proliferates and then influences a more democratic environment. One could claim perhaps in China where we're witnessing that phenomenon. And again, capitalism on its own has led to unprecedented wealth, the distribution of comfort in ways that, thank God, hundreds of years ago, people died of starvation and poverty. I know that KTAM is now facing a water crisis, and I'm happy for the time that I'm here to participate in that from a moral standpoint, from a civic standpoint, to be careful, to conserve. But water crisis, this is an exception in the modern world. It's becoming more and more common. Every human being lived in a water crisis hundreds of years ago. Poverty, victims to natural causes, vulnerable. Thank God. The unprecedented wealth, comfort, luxury, which in and of themselves lead to the buoyancy of human spirit, the ability to dream, to create, to build. These are all the products of capitalism. But capitalism is fueled by the market. And the market is fueled by supply and demand. And this has led to the great age of consumerism. What is the consumer price index? How is consumer confidence doing? Black Friday, the great high holy days of consumerism. The Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur of consumerism. Now it's just like in Chutz La'aretz, you have 2 days of Yom Kippur, so now it's Friday and Sunday, Monday. Next for day.
And as I said before, these terms worm their way into our consciousness. And that's how we see ourselves. We're all consumers. I asked the same question I asked before with different terms. That is why we were placed in this world to consume. Man is defined as a consumer. We live lives of consumption. We're producers. We're workers. We're laborers. We're contributors. We consume in order to replenish, in order to enable the continued productivity. Remember that God expels Adam from the Garden of Eden and curses him to work by the sweat of his brow. But that's only the second time God speaks to Adam about working. Before the fall, when man is still in his pristine and native state, God places man in the Garden of Eden before the fall, where man is still perfect. To work and to protect. We're custodians of God's wealth. We're environmentalists, not because we sense an animate nature in Mother Nature, that's idolatry. We're environmentalists because we're protecting God's masterpiece, and we're the stewards and the custodians. I had a great rabbi. His name was Rabbi Lichtenstein. He told me about life. Whenever he
every feature of human experience,
every element of human character I saw modeled in him.
Very soft-spoken, very genteel, very kind and compassionate. I never heard him speak negatively about anything. I never heard him say the word hate, except once. He once said, "I hate laziness. I can't tolerate laziness. It's waste. It's slandering. But we're all consumers. Everything is merchandise. And if we watch a commercial of an attractive husband and a beautiful wife driving their three children in a Volvo, we'll buy the Volvo. Or if we see an attractive person showering with a bar of soap with a brand name on it, we'll spend double for that bar of soap because we buy into that fantasy. Live within your means. Live non-frugal, responsible. Won't just create financial fitness, personal stability, equilibrium, emotional well-being. But we've all run on the treadmill of rampant consumerism."
And that's the fifth danger of modern democracy. The final danger I wanted to speak about is a great irony. Democracy has also led to mass urbanization. Somehow, living under common governance rather than despotic or tyrannical rule has encouraged people to live in larger clusters, larger cities. It's more difficult for a tyrant to maintain multi-regional authority. But we live together under common democratic interests. It's led to the modern city. Urban sprawl. Megacities. Metropolises of tens of millions of people. And again, this, in and of itself, provides great benefits. Common well-being. Culture, the evolution of culture, in ways that are unprecedented. Culture emerges from a ricochet of human imagination, human expression. A lot of great comfort, mass distribution of human welfare and prosperity. It's created certain challenges. Again, we're facing the war challenge. Sometimes the population growth exceeds the infrastructure and the ability to provide needs and utilities. But the era of the modern city has also produced a challenge. Policy decisions, policy making. How to determine policy for millions of people? In order to shape policy, trends have to be detected. How do human beings live? What are their tendencies? What are the trends that we can plan 5 years in advance, 10 years in advance, so we can determine when the water levels are shrinking too low, and not wait for that last moment when our reservoirs run entirely dry? But not just, of course, in water conservation, in general, crime, economy, infrastructure, housing, residents. Trends have to be detected. The need to detect trends has led to the evolution of a modern science. It's called the science of statistics. Statistics is a relatively new science. There were no statisticians in the 17th century, or very few. They didn't have the resources to collect data, to crunch the numbers. We now live in a world in which the internet has allowed for big data and processing information at larger levels beyond just local experiences or local theaters. That in and of itself is welcome. The ability to plan for the future. To live a life which isn't random or capricious, but planned, thought out, outlined. As I mentioned before, every human experience shapes our identity. And the world of statistics, ironically, which is
The byproduct of democracy has created a world which feels very, very predetermined. Because when statistics suggest human behavior, how free do we feel? How often do we feel like depersonalized individuals is part of a larger statistic? How free do we truly feel to shape our world, to affect our world, to change our world? I had a conversation with some students about 5 months ago. I almost cried. They were at my table Friday night, and I was talking about dreams, changing the world, asserting your opportunity, choosing professions that will make a difference. And one student, the Israeli boy, raised his hand and said, "Rabbi, our generation doesn't feel that. Our generation feels very, very limited. The world is shrinking, and with the horizons are shrinking. The world is large, but communication shrinks our world." And the great irony of democracy is that it's far more predetermined than a world without democracy, which we aren't told about human trends. There is an expression in the United States 15, 20 years ago, which really irritated me. One of the TV stations was trying to publicize a night that had fantastic programs. And they called it must-see TV. Must-see TV. I'll determine which channel to watch. But you have to watch these stations. I'm sure there are equivalent events in South Africa. I'm not aware of them. But when you hear that 80 million people are watching the Super Bowl, the American football, Grand Fiesta, feel compelled to be where everyone else is, to be part of that statistic. This is an event, and it calls you, it beckons you. And that's part of the challenge, our individualism, our freedom of choice. That is who we are as human beings. The very famous statement of Maimonides in the 5th chapter, of the laws of repentance, because repentance is not just about tshuva, improvement, it's about recognizing the unlimited freedom that every human being possesses. Every human being, Maimonides writes, has the ability to be like Moses, or to sink in a moral morass like the greatest criminal. How free do you feel? How unlimited do you express your freedom of choice? I don't just mean in the day-to-day decisions, what to eat, what to wear, who to vote for. It's all past. These headline-grabbing experiences, all fade. Who you are, what you dream of, what impact you'll leave in this world, what will your obituary be like, how will people speak of you, how will your great-grandchildren speak about your picture on their wall. That's the freedom that I think sometimes is under siege. Because we're all just a part of a larger statistic. So these are the 6 areas to be careful about. Thank God. I would not trade our world for the world 200 years ago for any price. Not as a Jew or not as a Gentile. The world is in a far better place. I hope to speak about this later. Much of it is our doing. Can I have how much longer do we have? 5 minutes? And this is God's expression. There is a phrase we recite during the holy days. V'chol ma'aminim. Everyone agrees, everyone admits, Shehu levado, that he's exclusive. Hamamlech melachim v'lo hamrucham. God coronates kings. Well, sometimes he coronates kings, but he also provides human beings with political instinct to determine and to develop forms of government. The democracy that we live through is an expression of that instinct that God invested and embedded within the human imagination to reimagine forms of government that would be more fair and more equitable. And as I mentioned before, as Jews, to appreciate the world we live in. Who would have thought? Who would have thought 80 years after the Jewish world was in embers, was in shattered, that we live in such viable communities offering Jews stability, influence, thank God, affluence. God forbid to decry or to disparage the achievements of democracy. But it masks certain dangers. And the challenge is to embrace democracy without the infiltration of some of the values which could be seen as contradictory to who we are as Jews. We live for freedom, but not the freedom of democracy. The freedom of immortality. The freedom to manage this incredible mechanism that God delivered to us and to employ it with balance and success rather than deranged and unbridled. We embrace hierarchies. We embrace family hierarchies. We embrace rabbinic hierarchies.
Passover, we'll sit around the table. We'll remind ourselves of that hierarchy. We defend our rights. Number three, we don't live for rights. We live for duty and calling and mission. There is clarity in the moral compass and the moral spectrum between right and wrong. We have to be willing to call that clarity and evoke it when it's being questioned, defiantly and courageously. We're consumers so that we can be producers, not as an end to itself. And we stand free in our own individual choices, as much as statistics whisper to us that we're just part of some larger human trend. Let me end with something marginally related. You know how people say, at first, I wanted to change the world. That was too difficult. So I contracted and focused on changing my family. That was too difficult. We live in a confusing world. So I withdrew even more. I decided I'm just going to work on changing myself. That's not the way it happens. Don't fall prey to stereotypical thinking. You know what really happens in life? First, people try to change themselves. When that becomes too difficult, they try to change the family. And when that becomes too difficult, they try to change the world. First, look at yourself. First, reconstruct, solidify your own internal fortress. That's yours. Your values, your thoughts, your behavior. Maybe you'll be successful in changing your family, hopefully with God's help. Maybe you won't. Maybe if God gives you an opportunity, you'll change the world. Maybe you won't. It's done from inside. Know yourself. Live through great moments of history as Jews and as human beings. But be careful not to be seduced into some of the adulterated impacts that democracy whispers into our ear and infuses into our hearts. Have a great day.
Thank you.
This is a good question. I normally spell it with a taf. Taf avresh, gimel vavdal. So if a Yemenat is a soft taf, you could get a third.
Commentary and
the muscle. Yeah. The best thing about the
Korean
muscle
is that no one has the emotion.
Nobody sees that I'm playing. I made a mistake for these, applying a whole bunch for the show.